From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, teachers, parents, and kids all adjusting to the new normal at home.
They're confused and they're sad, and I think the novelty of being home from school is going to start wearing out pretty soon.
We'll check in with an A-list teacher parent. Also, an independent bookseller turns his storefront into an online order fulfillment center.
A lot of the dystopian novels are sold out right now, which is interesting that people want to deep dive into a dystopian, you know, apocalyptic settings.
On that note, we will give you a taste of some books that you might want to hunker down with.
When you read it, you know it. Like, you absolutely know it. Or if you see the book, one of the books I'm going to talk about today, as soon as I saw it, I mean, I knew it was a notable book.
Those conversations and more on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later this hour, we're going to be checking in with one of Michigan's small businesses. Literati Books has a customer base that would like to keep buying during the COVID-19 shutdown, but the store is racing to come up with a way to do business online.
We typically get 5 to 10 web orders, and we've gotten over 700, so we are frantically trying to fulfill those before any kind of mandatory quarantine hits.
First, though, a salute to everybody out there all across Michigan today holding it down with the kiddos. If you are at home with kids who are getting cabin feverish, who don't understand why they can't hang out with friends, or who are maybe just a little freaked out about all the changes that have happened over the past week, you're in very good company. A lot of Michigan educators are right there with you. In fact, no less than Michigan's Teacher of the Year 2019-2020 is at home with her kids this week. Kara Lougheed teaches English and history at Stony Creek High School at Rochester Community Schools, and she joins us now for a sanity check. Kara, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Do you mind saying how old your kids are?
Sure. My boys are 11 and 15, and they are in 6th and 9th grade, and they go to Romeo Community Schools.
How's it going?
It's going. We created a schedule together that is very flexible for them, and we're trying to stick to it. You know, I think we're just doing the best that we can. My husband's also a teacher, so that helps.
Right. What are you doing to keep the learning going?
So their teachers in Romeo have posted what they would like them to do, which has been incredibly helpful for me. I teach English and history. My husband teaches math and health and PE.
Oh, so you've pretty much got it covered.
We do have a lot of things covered, but we still don't know exactly what they should be doing. So Romeo has been incredibly, they moved so fast, and they got this stuff out that just have activities for them to do. It's not overwhelming. And so what we did is we said twice a day, we're going to have school time. We're not doing school all day long. We're going to sit down and we're going to pick something to work on. And so far that's going really well. We also have some reading time. We all sit down and read together. And then we also try to either take a walk or do some kind of, activity together. And I mean, it's going okay, but for us, the key is flexibility. So we have these things during the day, but it doesn't always have to happen at the exact same time.
Right. Are there certain things that seem important to stay on the kids about, and maybe some things that are a little bit less important that parents can just let slide?
I think that it's hard because it's different for your age group. So, for example, with my boys who are in middle and high school, I want to make sure that they are still reading every day, that they were trying to learn something new every day, regardless of which subject it is, that they're talking to us about how they're feeling. I think it's really important at every age. But for the younger ones, you may want to have more consistency every day. You might want to have specific times where you sit down and do some math and do a science experiment and do some reading. I think it just really depends on the age and the personality of your children. But top of my list, obviously, is reading. I think every kid should be reading every day if possible. Adults should too.
For sure. Are you still in touch with some of the students at Stony Creek?
So when you are Michigan Teacher of the Year, sometimes you get released from the classroom. And so I have not had my own students this year, which has been very strange for me. But my colleagues are all in touch with their students and have been learning all kinds of new technologies. I've been watching my husband figure out how to do Zoom and how to navigate Google Classroom better. And then I'm in touch with my kids from last year, my students from last year, just through social media mostly, and some little projects that my school has been working on. So I do feel a little bit out of it because I don't have my own students, but I'm really confident in what my district, Rochester Community Schools, has been doing to make sure that all of our staff can contact their students.
The kids that you have been able to touch base with, how do they sound?
So the seniors are really disappointed, and my heart breaks for them. The kids are wanting some sense of normalcy, so they don't mind that their teachers are reaching out. They're confused and they're sad, and I think the novelty of being home from school is going to start wearing out pretty soon. But I think they also, because of the work of my district and other districts in Michigan, are feeling like there's a plan, and you know, they can get in touch with their teachers and they know what their principals are doing. And so that's been kind of a bright spot in all of it, is that I do feel like the kids know what to do, like know where to go to get their questions answered. So that, I think, has made me feel a little bit better for them. But mostly they're kind of weirded out and concerned, I think.
Yeah. You know, it seems like there's such a huge challenge here, both for districts to ramp up their operations quickly and suddenly deliver online learning when they didn't think they'd have to be, and also for parents to try to keep up with, you know, supporting their kids and helping them with their lessons. Do you have any advice for parents who are trying to stay on top of the tech and figure out how best they can support what their kids need to be doing right now?
Absolutely. I think the biggest thing is just give yourself a little grace. Have patience, pace yourself. Like, don't set an obnoxiously rigorous schedule for your kids that you're not going to be able to keep up with a week from now. If a day goes by where there's no school, oh well, it's not the end of the world. I think it's most important that our kids and our students know that we love them and that we are working on it and that everything's going to be okay. And school can come second to that.
Do you think it's important to be real with kids about our own frustrations with this period?
You know, I think that kind of depends on the age. And I'm not a child psychologist, so I don't really know, like, if there's a broad answer for that. We've been upfront with our kids because they have questions and we answer them. But I think that's kind of a question that every parent has to answer for themselves and gauge where their own children are at and what would scare them versus what would make them feel better, just like you would with anything, any scary thing that happens.
Do you have concerns about how this pause, for lack of a better term, is going to affect today's students in the long term? I mean, it's got some, as you mentioned, it's got some huge repercussions for kids who are seniors this year. But I mean, it seems like we might be looking at students in Michigan missing as much as a whole semester of school.
Yeah, that is a possibility. The Kansas Teacher of the Year is a friend of mine, and they just canceled school for the remainder of the year. They do get out a month earlier than we do. You know, I don't know what the ramifications are, and I can't really predict that. I do know that our kids are resilient, and our parents are smart, and they love their kids, and teachers aren't going anywhere. So whatever happens, my district, MBE, Michigan Department of Education, everyone across the state is going to work to make sure that our kids are taken care of. I feel really confident in the people that are figuring this out, especially with what my district has been doing. I'm just really proud of them.
Kara, you tweeted out something this week saying that, just so everyone is clear, my children are not the least bit impressed at being homeschooled by the Michigan Teacher of the Year.
Right. So when he saw my tweet about not being impressed by being homeschooled by the Michigan Teacher of the Year, he actually came to me and was like, well, Mom, I mean, it's kind of cool, I guess, that you're our homeschool teacher. So he gave me a little props, I guess, a few props.
Oh, jeez. Beautiful. Kara Lougheed teaches high school English and history at Stony Creek High School. Kara, thank you so much for taking a couple minutes out of your homeschooling schedule to speak to us.
Thank you so much. You have a great day.
There are tons of kids out there just trying to figure their way through this strange period. And some of them may be at home with you. We've been keeping up with a few kids at Community High in Ann Arbor. Let's listen to them. Here they are sharing their feelings on a hotline that Michigan Radio set up for them.
It is March 15th, it's Sunday, 10:30 at night. My first time calling the hotline for this corona thing. I don't know, it's truly scary. Because, like, I don't know what's going to happen.
Today I hung out with some friends, and my siblings are also gone. So I'm a little bit worried about when they get home, who they've been in contact and who those people have been in contact with to make sure they don't have it. So then I don't spread it to anyone else.
I'm not a huge fan of being at home all the time and not having things to do.
I've just been hanging out crafting. I like to design stationery using flower catalogs, like cutting them out and collaging. And I never get time to do that because it's really time consuming. So I've just been doing that.
I was just on a meeting call and my 4-year-old brother came in like half naked screaming at me. I was like, what is happening? Just trying to get stuff done around them. It's very difficult.
It's 7:24 on March 17th, 2020, and I'm on a walk with my family right now. We've been doing 1 or 2 walks a day to get us out of the house. Yeah, you guys have anything you want to say?
The grocery store was empty today.
Yeah, we're running out of things.
I'm going to go watch Netflix now and try to avoid the situation. Bye.
Okay, bye. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Voices of students from Community High School in Ann Arbor as they adjust to the new normal during the coronavirus outbreak. That audio postcard was produced by Rachel Ishikawa. Coming up, a year-long project capturing 365 Michigan sunrises and the pleasures of living in the moment.
For most of us, the sunrise is something we experience by happenstance on our commute to work, see it from the kitchen window, but we rarely make the sunrise the destination.
That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer.
Final seconds playing out. End of a fabulous tournament. Rebound into the hands of Hunter. And Virginia with the all-time turnaround title.
Normally around this time of year, sports fans would be poring over our March Madness brackets using sophisticated statistical analysis or the old tried and true gut feeling to guess which teams will advance to the Final Four. But concerns over the spread of coronavirus have shut down the NCAA Division I men's and women's basketball tournaments. The good news is your TV viewing schedule is now wide open. Why not fill it up with some movies? For the next week, Stateside is putting together our own version of a March Madness tournament. We have selected for you 16 films set in, filmed in, or about Michigan. And we want you to help us narrow it down to the most quintessentially Michigan movie of them all. Which film best captures what it means to live in the mitten? Since you can't have an office bracket without an office, we're going to be doing it all on Instagram. Starting today through next Friday, you'll be able to vote for your favorite Michigan movies in daily matchups. You can find our list of the Sweet 16 contenders at MichiganRadio.org, and then head over to Michigan Radio's Instagram page. Click on our stories to join in. How about a little something different on this Friday? Let's take a collective breath. Earlier this year, we spoke with someone who did a thing that most of us do not have the time, energy, or wherewithal to pull off. Bugsy Saylor took a photograph of the sunrise every day for a year. Bugsy lives in Marquette. He's the owner of the Upper Peninsula Supply Company and a sometime photographer. Here's our conversation about his project. Bugsy Saylor, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, what in God's name possessed you to get up so early for an entire year?
Well, that I'm not really sure, but I can tell you the practical story behind it. Years ago, 2013, I started a new tradition to photograph the first sunrise of the new year and take a little road trip along the Great Lakes. So it became every January 1st for 7 years straight. I'd go photograph the first sunrise no matter what the weather was doing. But it turned out I really wouldn't see many sunrises from one January 1st to the next. So it was literally the day before December 31st, 2018. I was like, well, what if I just watch every sunrise of 2019? The idea is simple, but you know, the execution and commitment is certainly a whole other level.
Well, are you naturally a morning person?
I'm not a morning person. I have not gotten up this consistent, I mean, my entire life. I mean, I think of grade school girl going up, you know, or work, but there was always weekends to sleep in, even a little bit. but there wasn't a single day where I could allow myself to do that.
Some of these are absolutely gorgeous, postcard perfect sunrise photos. And then there were some that just had me cackling with happiness. The January 30th at Picnic Rocks, for example, there is no sun at sunrise. It's just completely fogged in.
Yeah, and that's part of the experience. And you know, the hardest thing is on the website, it says, did the sun rise? Yes. Was it visible? No, maybe. Yes, certainly. Who knows? That's part of the commitment. And I think the more cloudy days you have in a row, the greater the reward is once you have a clear, beautiful orange day.
I was having a hard time choosing a favorite myself. They're just gorgeous winter shots with the sun streaming over the snow and really lavish summer photos where you can practically hear the birds as you look at the sun breaking through dewdrops in the grass. But did you have a favorite of these?
You know, I've been asked that a lot, and honestly, I just have to keep going back to January 1st, and it was such an incredible morning at Whitefish Point along Lake Superior, and if it wasn't such an inspiring morning, I don't know if this project would have ever come to fruition. I think the inspiration from that first morning just stayed within me for such a long time. And I just wanted to return to that. Like, I didn't know how many more sunrises I was going to have to see to get that same amount of joy. But it was something that, you know, I would revisit several times throughout the year.
Just to describe it a little bit, there's a dusting of snow on the beach. And then the sunrise is just exploding like a supernova in oranges and purples and gold. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it almost looks like there's this, I don't know, it's out of this world, you know, like something's taking off or landing on Earth. And yeah, these purples and oranges. And it was a cold, windy morning. It was not pleasant to feel in some degree, but the view was astonishing.
What do you feel like you got out of doing this, seeing it through every single day of 2019?
Yeah, to me, the sunrise is a moment of meditation now, and there's great reward in it in terms of being present and calm and relaxed throughout your day. You know, you can have a beautiful sunrise and still have a terrible day, but it gives you something to look back on that you started the day on the right foot. And I think for most of us, the sunrise is something we experience by happenstance. It's something we see on our commute to work, see it from the kitchen window, but we rarely make the sunrise the destination. And I think there's great reward physically and emotionally when you do that.
So many of us make resolutions in December, and then by March or April rolling around, we've just pretty much given up. Do you have any advice on seeing something like this all the way through?
Yes, and this was a particularly aggressive resolution, but I think what works is my resolution could have easily been, in 2019, I'm going to spend more time outside and take more photos. And if that was my resolution, I don't think I would have lasted 2 months. But the way I set it up, that I'm going to photograph every sunrise, it became a very simple yes or no answer every day. Did I do this or did I not? So the accountability of it was incredibly simple.
I suppose having the accountability of everybody looking at your pictures online didn't hurt either.
Yeah, when you make something public, it's a whole other commitment that you have to keep up with this.
Bugsy, thanks for telling us about the project.
Yes, thanks so much for having me. I hope for anybody who enjoyed it, I will say, if you have one takeaway, I hope you see more sunrises in 2020 than you did in 2019. It only has to be one more and I will be happy.
Bugsy Sailor lives in Marquette. He's the owner of the Upper Peninsula Supply Company. You can see a few of those 2019 sunrises that we were talking to Bugsy about at michiganradio.org. Some small businesses may not experience very much disruption this year. Pretty much anyone whose sales do not rely on brick-and-mortar retail. It's a fabulous time to be in the hand sanitizer business. For other business owners, the closures related to COVID-19 may be a death sentence. But for some businesses, there might be a way through this if they can figure out how to deliver the goods. Mike Gustafson owns Literati Bookstore in Ann Arbor with his wife Hillary. The store usually sells only in person, but is now facing an overwhelming demand for online sales. Mike Gustafson, welcome to Stateside. How are you adjusting?
We have not scaled back our staff necessarily as far as payroll is concerned. We're committed to paying our staff through the end of March if they have made the decision to come in and work or not. After March, I just don't know what's going to happen. Like thousands of other small businesses, if there's no income flow, we anticipate having to make tough decisions. This past weekend, you know, we sort of put the word out there what we were doing. We closed on Friday around noon, and we typically get 5 to 10 web orders, orders through our online website, literatibookstore.com, and we've gotten over 700. So we are frantically trying to fulfill those before any kind of mandatory quarantine hits.
Mike, you posted on the website you've been inundated with people asking you to send them books. Can you tell us what happened?
So on Friday, we had a little bit of whiplash, as so many other small businesses did, because we quickly made the decision to close down our shop at about noon, and our manager just walked around the bookstore and said that we were going to close doors. There wasn't anything that happened. Nobody had tested positive for coronavirus. We just thought that it was in the interest of public safety, especially since we're such a congregation site in downtown Ann Arbor and the library was closing and schools were closing. We were really worried that people were going to start to congregate at the bookstore and put our staff and other customers at risk. So we immediately closed down, shut the doors, and posted online that we were going to take web orders. For any independent brick and mortar store, the internet is sort of this final frontier. We, quote unquote, compete against other online industries that can fulfill web orders, including Amazon.
I was going to say, including a small company people might have heard of called Amazon.com.
Yeah, we all live in Jeff Bezos land. So we're competing against Jeff Bezos and his small business. We put it out there and we typically get 5 to 10 online orders a day. And we have had over 700 and they continue to roll in. Which it almost feels like a scene out of an old-timey movie.
Wow.
Where people around not just Ann Arbor, but around the entire country are putting their money where their mouths are and saying, we don't want you to close. I think a lot of people are really starting to understand the serious and potentially perilous situation that small businesses like mine, who have under 50 employees, are faced with in the not just the coming weeks, but the coming months. So this kind of support definitely gives us a boost. It has given us a morale booster. Our staff feels supported by the community, but at the same time, we're staring not just being closed throughout March, but potentially much longer. So we also understand the long road ahead.
Mike, has the bookstore started to look any different? I mean, are you just drowning in packing materials now?
Yeah, if you peeked in through our windows, we've basically turned into a fulfillment center. We have boxes scattered around the bookstore sales. We have an office space next door. At the same time, we're following all health protocols. So people are keeping their distance and we're setting up workstations. It's not like we've got all 30 employees packed into the bookstore working in different areas. Everybody's keeping clear distances of each other, but it doesn't necessarily look like a clean and tidy independent bookshop anymore. There's packing materials and boxes and labels, and we're all trying to adjust as quickly as possible. And again, we had maybe one or two people on staff that were doing web orders. So in addition to trying to fulfill all these web orders, we're training our employees to fulfill web orders and reach out to people. And it's a good problem to have. It still is a challenge, but it's a good challenge for right now.
Are the shipping costs going to kill you?
We switched from charging people full rate for media mail, which is usually $3 or $4, depending on where we're shipping. Now we offer $1 shipping flat rate, and we eat those costs. We have noticed as soon as we advertised that we were switching to $1, our online orders increased substantially. So margins were already tight, as they are for any independent business, but especially for an independent bookstore. But the increase of orders will hopefully balance that out.
Are you able to pay your staff right now?
Yes, we are paying all coffee shop and bookstore part-time and full-time staff through the end of March. Hillary and I have dedicated and set aside some personal savings to pay this payroll just to give everybody on staff a fighting chance. And after March, I'm just not sure. We reached out to staff saying there are more questions than answers right now. We're hopeful that because so many of us are in the same position, that there could be some creative solutions nationwide about this challenge. But we're just trying to do everything possible to give our employees just a fighting chance at the next coming weeks and months.
Mike, this was supposed to be a relatively light year for the publishing industry in terms of new titles coming out. It's an election year, and that means books tend to get a bit less attention. Do you worry about what's going on in publishing as a result of all this, sort of at the earlier stages of your supply chain?
I think there are definitely some supply chain concerns, especially amongst kids' books. Children's books have been printed in China, and they're switching to different countries like Malaysia. We've checked in with some of our children's books authors, and they say it's sort of the Wild West out there right now. And depending on what happens, inventory could be a considerable concern as far as printing and getting books. There's so many unknowns at the moment, it's hard to predict what's going to happen. And both the beauty and curse of what we do as a small independent shop is we may need to transition what we offer. And we've been brainstorming like crazy. There will be still an interest in entertainment and exchange of ideas. And so if we can no longer offer physical books because of some kind of supply chain hiccup, what could we do? Ideas that we've thrown around are digital book clubs, online writing courses. We have a full staff of people who have MFA degrees, different kinds of education services, because we're all going to be sitting at home. And at the same time, that could be working to our advantage if we can figure out a way to reach people in a meaningful way. There are an abundance of different challenges ahead, but we're really racking our brains on how we can shift as quickly as we can.
You know, it's funny. I feel like I have crept back so far into my comfort zone, picking up the literary equivalent of comfort food. I started reading a 20-year-old title by Colson Whitehead. Do you have recommendations for home reading for people who are maybe housebound right now and just looking for something new, something different?
Oh, absolutely. It's funny that you mentioned that, because a lot of the dystopian novels are sold out right now, which is interesting that people want a deep dive into a dystopian, you know, apocalyptic settings. And I'm sort of the other way. I'd like a little bit of escapism. And I'm looking for, now that I've got some separation from work, I'm working from home, I would recommend for anybody out there just wanting to feel some calmness, there are two of my favorite books. One is Gilead by Marilynne Robinson, which is a beautiful novel about a pastor who is writing to his very young son at sort of towards the end of his life. Marilynne Robinson writes in a way that has these chewy literary sentences, and it's very slow and meditative, which I think is what a lot of people would appreciate right now. And then my other favorite book I would recommend is a very old book. It's by Aldo Leopold, and it's called A Sand County Almanac, and it's my personal favorite book of all time. Sand County Almanac is about a man who sort of, it's a nonfiction book, a series of essays, and he walks around in his backyard in Wisconsin, and he observes what's happening in his backyard and writes about it in such a beautiful way. I remember reading that book when I was in my 20s, just after college, and I was feeling very jealous because a lot of my friends were traveling the world and going overseas and doing backpack trips around Europe, and I was not. I moved to Los Angeles for a job, and I was feeling jealous and I read that book and I realized if we all look very, very closely, even in our backyards, we can experience beauty and we can experience adventure and we can be more attuned and more aware to what's happening in our surroundings. And I think that's needed very much right now. I think people need to be aware and not just pay attention to one news source, pay attention to many news sources, but also pay attention to their community and much more closely pay attention to our neighbors. I wrote this on Facebook, but let's share our toilet paper with our neighbors. Let's share our resources with our neighbors. Let's reach out to our neighbors. And I love a Sand County Almanac because it showed me at the time how much there is right in front of us if we just look closely.
Mike Gustafson owns Literati Bookstore in Ann Arbor with his wife Hillary. After the break, we'll make your reading list delightfully longer. We're going to go over this year's list of Michigan notable books, fiction, nonfiction, even a cookbook.
I knew seeing this book, and I'm not a cookbook person. When I looked at this book, the first thing before I even looked at the recipes was, this book is beautiful.
That's next on Stateside. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Have you plowed through all the reads that you intended to get to this week? Me too. It's time to tee off your next wave of social distancing books. Every year, the Library of Michigan compiles a list of Michigan notable books. We're talking stories about Michigan or set here, and also those that are written by Michigan authors. Today, we welcome two of the librarians involved in the selection process. Tim Gleisner is manager of special collections at the Library of Michigan. Tim, how are you doing?
I'm good today. Thank you, April.
And Jessica Trotter is a librarian with the Capital Area District Library. Jessica, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
All these books have to have some connection to Michigan, whether they are about Michigan or written by someone who's from here. But that word that you use to title the list, notable, it is wonderfully flexible. What, in your view, makes a book really notable? What boxes does it have to tick as you're reading it?
I'll start. I guess for me, one thing that really stands out for many of the books that we choose is just something that it's hard to really put your arms around it, but basically just, you know, when you read it, you know it. Like, you absolutely know it. Or if you see the book, one of the books I'm going to talk about today, as soon as I saw it, I mean, I knew it was a notable book. And usually the committee overall has that same feeling.
Jessica, how would you answer that question?
I understand what Tim is talking about, but also for me there's a bit of relevance that pops out for me. I'm thinking of a couple of the titles, actually, including the titles that Tim's going to talk about. There's just something about them that speaks to the year that we're looking at or the year that we're looking forward to. There's things that just hit me because they are so identifiable to me as Michigan and just also have a great story or a great, you know, premise, whatever type of book it is.
And actually, I would jump on what Jessica is saying. I mean, I completely agree with her because there were two titles from last year's list that would not, I think, really be as relevant for this year. And we would have passed on just due to the topic and the currency of the topic.
Right. I don't know that we'd have passed on them this year.
There's one from this year, and I guess I can give the title, The Girls, about the Larry Nassar case that just was something that just, I mean, you knew, but when you read it, you absolutely were like, yes, we have to have this book. But the currency of it was just something that, I mean, you had to look at it at the very least to just know that it was a title for this year.
Do you think there are things that set the Great Lakes literary tradition apart?
I mean, I think the question of water, you know, just the lakes themselves, a book that won Death and Life of the Great Lakes. I mean, I think that's something that really stands out for me. And then really books that I've seen, industrial settings, for some reason that pops out in my mind. But Jessica, I'm sure, can speak.
Oh, I'm kind of thinking about some of the ones that we're looking at this year and thinking more about. There's a Michigan twist on Midwest that I think
Oh, as a Buckeye, I really am curious to hear what you mean by that. Could you say more?
Well, in a way, it's kind of going into one of the books that I want to talk about. So there are books where it's very clear that the person is sort of coming from somewhere else and trying to get used to the Midwest. And, you know, part of it's just pulling in the iconic things that have shaped Michigan, such as everything going on in Detroit, the industrial part of it, the cultural Motown, things like that. I mean, it just pulls a little different to me than maybe some of the other Midwestern states.
Well, let's get to it. Jessica, what's the book that you have in mind about this?
This one's actually Come See About Me, Marvin. It's poems by Brian G. Gilmore. This one really hit me. Gilmore's he's from D.C. originally, and he came to Michigan to teach social justice law at MSU. And this collection is sort of that getting to know you part of, you know, adjusting to Michigan. And it's presented as sort of a dialogue with Marvin Gaye.
Oh, wow.
Who also left D.C. to further his career and ended up in the Midwest, first in Chicago and then in Detroit.
I think a lot of people may get a little intimidated by poetry. They worry that they won't get it. What's your pitch to people for picking up this book?
This one's so accessible. It's so part of it's very clearly mid-Michigan. Not totally, but there are things that are just very clearly mid-Michigan. He's talking about places I can identify on the road on I-96, like his first winter bad weather driving. Was going to a presentation in Grand Rapids and hitting, there is a spot on I-96, which I have hit, I don't know how many times, that ice is over before you get to an emergency exit. And it's like I can see it in this particular set of poems. He does just a very good job of bringing very real places to life.
Is there something from the book you could read to us?
Yeah. There are a number that are just, I think my favorites are probably very long. But actually, this one is the Grand Rapids poem. It's called Grand Rapids for KK. I'm just going to read a first stanza of it.
Sure.
And then the snow came, like in that book, into thin air. And I was happy we weren't climbing the Himalayas. I was just on my way to Grand Rapids to do a seminar on discrimination. And we were just about there when someone tossed a white bed sheet on our windshield and our tires became skates on a sheet of ice. Now I knew why much of the time on these trips you could look to the right or left and you could see cars in the trees, driver out, airbags engaged, cell phone in the air.
That's amazing.
And that goes on. That's actually a longer poem. And it's just one of those things where you're like, I know exactly the spot he's talking about. I have driven past those cars and I know that situation.
Tim, one of the books that you chose is a cookbook this year. Mm-hmm. It's called Roughage, A Practical Guide to Vegetables. Will you tell us a little bit more about the author, Abra Behrens?
Well, Abra is a chef and farmer here in Michigan, currently in Three Oaks, previously in Northport up in the Leelanau Peninsula, and then also over, she was trained over at Zingerman's Deli. And the reason why I said earlier that there are books that you just know that are notable titles, I knew seeing this book, and I'm not a cookbook person. When I looked at this book, the first thing before I even looked at the recipes was, this book is beautiful. Just in the format that it's in, the cover itself, the illustrations, just the way it's broken up by, you know, the sections or chapters by vegetable, one vegetable, discrete vegetable per chapter. So Abra Behrens is this person who very much believes in seasonal, eating, and it's just a wonderful book broken up with different vignettes of her life with experiences of cooking. One very powerful one is in the section about broccoli, where her father is like literally cooking to heal himself. And she shares that experience with him cooking bacon after the passing of her mother, his wife. I can't speak enough about this book. For me, this was like the one of them where I just basically am like, yep, that's a notable book.
Have you made any of the dishes from the book yet?
Yeah, I've made two dishes. One was broccoli, fitting enough, because I love broccoli. And it was really just essentially, basically dousing it oil, chili flakes, roasting the broccoli with the chili oil or the oil and the chili flakes, and then basically grating Parmesan cheese on it. That was my dinner that one night when I made that. And then another one was carrots, again, roasting, but this time with a jam and almonds. And it was just a fantastic meal. And the one thing I love about her recipes is she speaks to someone like me, where she says, you know, if you're going to, you know, douse these in oil, use a glug of oil, you know, and like I can picture in my mind what a glug is, right? Like you just kind of shoot the oil in the bowl and then you, right? And so, I mean, it's very simple, easy for someone like me who, quite frankly, when it comes to vegetables, if it's not out of a frozen bag when I get home at night, I really don't do much else. Yeah, I just can't speak enough about this book.
That sounds amazing. Jessica, another one of your favorites from the list is The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls by Anissa Gray. She gets my vote for best title, by the way.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
Anissa Gray grew up in West Michigan, and that's where the book's set. It covers
St. Joseph.
Right. It covers the lives of three sisters. What's going on when we meet these women?
This is just in the aftermath of Althea and her husband, so the oldest sister and her husband, have just been arrested and convicted for defrauding their West Michigan community. And the two younger sisters are coming into town to look after their nieces. They have two nieces. And it's just, it's a family in crisis. And it's, everything is bringing out all the faults that have shaped this family. Hmm. And it's just starting to crumble, and you know, people will come through stronger, but it's looks at relationships between mothers and daughters. Althea basically raised her sisters, especially her baby sister. So it's mothers and daughters, it's relationships between siblings. There's a lot about issues of identity and body image, guilt and regrets. And it's one of those things, it was compared to The Mothers by Britt Bennett and T.R.I. Jones's An American Marriage.
Another couple of books about family.
Exactly. And it's just, it's, and for me, it was a surprisingly fast read for something that's so emotionally weighty. There's discussion of eating disorders. There's a lot going on in it.
Could you contrast it a bit with the two books by T.R.I. Jones and Britt Bennett that we just mentioned? What corners of family and identity does it explore that maybe we haven't seen anywhere else?
Well, the youngest sister has an eating disorder that she has been she's basically backslid on as these events are happening. She is split from a partner. She's in the Chicago area and coming up into West Michigan to help with the children it's a teenager who basically turned her mother and father in. She's sort of the whistleblower on this crime.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, so you've got all sorts of things going on. It's just the sisters part of it, and how that family dynamic of how if you lose a parent early, those relationships get really screwed up. In that, you know, an oldest child maybe raising the youngest child, that middle child gets somewhere lost in between. It's just a really interesting look at those relationships.
It sounds like one that'll stick with us for a long time.
It was actually the first thing I read last year, and mm-hmm. It never let go. In that sense, I was really fought for this one. I really, really wanted to make sure nothing happened.
And there was a strong contingent on the committee for that book.
Yes, they loved it. Yes.
They wanted that book beyond all else. Yeah.
Tim, I wanted to ask about another one of your picks. It's a nonfiction title called A Good American Family, The Red Scare and My Father by David Moranis. He's an associate editor at The Washington Post. What's the Michigan connection here?
Well, it's a trial that takes place back in the early 1950s in Detroit. Basically, it's during the Red Scare of the early 50s, the McCarthy era. And really, the Michigan connection is Elliot Marinus, the father of David, basically is put on trial for being a supposed communist at that time because of past connections that he had had earlier in life while he was attending school at U of M. For me, this is one of those books that really, when Jessica talks about, you know, this is a Michigan book, and really, like, you know, the setting of it, I'm not a native Michigander, but I don't think you could put this in my native state of Wisconsin, even my native hometown in Milwaukee. This is a Detroit story. The one that stands out to me the most is the grandmother who was the FBI informant in the local communist headquarters. And she for years was taking notes and passing along information on all these different people that she was coming into contact with, you know, in Detroit in the 30s and 40s, and basically keeping files on all of them, and nobody knew. Nobody had a clue. Nobody had an inkling of this woman who really was embedded, in the labor movement, the left movement of that time in Detroit. And it just the sheer volume of sources and notes and research that David Marinus did on this book, and the cast of characters, how they all came to Detroit, it really paints a scene of Detroit of being so diverse, grabbing so many people from so many different parts of the country who really made up that city, you know, from the large African-American population to the people who were coming from, you know, the rural Appalachian area, all mingling into this one urban setting, and then just really seeing like the scare, the Red Scare, not in Washington, D.C., like how we see it on TV today, you know, with McCarthy and everything else, but here in the center of the country, in Detroit, which was the labor capital of the United States, is probably still is today, you know, but I mean, it was just amazing.
Yeah, it seems like a little different picture of Detroit in the 50s than a lot of us have, you know, that level of betrayal and division.
Well, and, you know, and I think it was really endemic of the country as a whole, but to me, it was just, I think the thing to me is how complex that city is. You know, having lived in Michigan now for 20 years, I still sometimes can't get my head around Detroit. Detroit is a very complex, has a very extremely complex history. And this book, you know, touches on an aspect of it. In a time and a place that obviously was fraught with many divisions in our society. And I think that's another thing that really touched me was just looking at our current state of affairs today, you know, and realizing this has happened before. And you know, this is something that, you know, maybe will happen again, hopefully not. But if it does, you know, it's not the end of the world. There is hope. Again, this is one where after reading maybe 100, 150 pages, I'm like, this is a notable book. Mm-hmm.
You know, you touched on this with something you said before, but I have to ask, are the conversations when the committee gets together and really starts getting down to brass tacks about which books are going to make the list, are those friendly conversations or what's the room like?
They can be. No, they can be. I think sometimes people get very passionate about certain books. Mm-hmm. Another one that we knew that was extremely notable was Broke. And I know, you know, that's a different title altogether. But Broke was one that people got very passionate about in the last meeting. Like, yep, that one has to stay on. Mm-hmm. And it was about the bankruptcy of Detroit. But I think overall it's amicable. There are emotions do run high for certain books, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right. We tend to think of the literary centers of the United States as the cities where big publishing and big entertainment writing is centered. And obviously, there's a million great books coming out of New York and L.A., the places where a lot of writers go to pursue their careers. But what do you feel like readers get out of reading local?
Part of it's just a better understanding of what's going on around you or what's happened. One of the examples would be The World According to Fannie Davis. That book was really interesting to me. My father grew up in Detroit. I've lived most of my life actually in Lansing. But I'm reading this book about a woman whose mother ran numbers in Detroit in the African-American community. And I finished it and I turned to my father and said, the next time I saw him and said, so did you guys, I mean, I've been told everybody did, but did you guys play numbers? And he's like, before I'd even finished the question, he's trying to come up with the name of the lady who would come and take their bets every day. It's sort of like stop in for tea type thing. And it was just neat.
That's fantastic.
It just led to a really interesting conversation. But it was just a part that it was very intrinsic to him growing up, but I knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
Jessica Trotter is a librarian with the Capital Area District Library. We've also been talking with Tim Gleisner, manager of special collections at the Library of Michigan. They are part of the shadowy cabal of readers and curators who bring us the list of Michigan notable books every year. You two, thank you so much.
Thank you,
April. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Next week, we will continue to bring you the stories and voices we're hearing during this strange shift in our collective understanding of society. We'll talk about education, economy, and health as we all work to slow the spread of COVID-19. Stay home, wash your hands, and do make the most of your weekend. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you Monday.